Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today is part two in our presentation on Lord Leverhulme, the great philanthropic industrialist. And as always, my co-host is Max Musson from Western Spring. Well, shall we get into our Greatest Britons then for today, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's talk about Lord Leverhulme, William Hesketh Lever. Last episode, we learned about Port Sunlight, the model village, and how much effort went into looking after Lever's employees and raising their standards. We also heard how he formed a soap cartel with the aim of keeping the prices low for the customers, as lots of other products had started using palm oil and were starting to push the price up, particularly margarine. The newspapers got together and smeared Lever for doing this, losing him a small fortune in profits and causing the failure of his soap trust. And that's where we got to last week. And after we finished recording, Max, you were telling me you had a bit of a theory about why the newspapers may have done this. And I thought that would be worth bringing up here. So do you want to go into a bit about that? Why you think the newspapers were so against his soap trust?
Well, this was a period during which laissez-faire capitalism was on the increase, but laissez-faire capitalism doesn't always operate in the best interests of the people of a nation. Sometimes the people of a nation need to curb capitalism so that they can maintain their industries, so they can maintain their standard of living. And what Lever, in my opinion, faced here was a situation where because of changing the sort of industrial change, because of the types of foods that were being manufactured, now people were manufacturing margarines, where previously we'd relied far more on butter. The uses for palm oil were increasing, and so therefore the price of palm oil was going up. And as palm oil was one of the main components of soap, it was felt by Lever that in order to maintain their business model and to maintain the business model of other soap manufacturers so that they could continue to manufacture soap, so that the public could continue to afford it at the low cost that their cartel was trying to retain, he was then attacked by people who were laissez-faire capitalists who wanted market forces to dominate and who were quite happy for market forces to do that, because market forces very often creates instability, and instability provides the opportunity for changing fortunes. In a stable society, the opportunities to shake up the current status quo tend not to come along too often. And if you're in a kind of burgeoning capitalist society where people are trying to make fortunes for themselves, then those people, then they don't want social stability. They don't want industrial stability. They want instability and fluidity so that they can undercut people, and so that they can manipulate the markets in order to gain for themselves a larger market share. And I just think this was a war between Lever, who was a capitalist, who was a benevolent capitalist, and whose main objective, although obviously one of his objectives was to make profits so that his business could be profitable, but he always had an eye out for the best interests of his workers, and wanted to ensure that the business model that he operated and that the ethical capitalism that he advocated should prevail, and the cartel that he formed, in my view, was formed to that end. And so it was the agents of laissez-faire capitalism that probably were the enemies of him, and that were the ones who took the action in order to break up the cartel.
And it was all dirty tricks. It was all the mainstream media that were smearing him. I mean, it was his business model that was really being attacked, which was a paternal capitalist business model where you looked after your employees, you raised their standards of living, and at the same time, you provided the products as good products, quality products, as cheaply as possible for the people, without stamping on others and trying to make a quick buck. So it was really disgusting what the newspapers actually did to him. And perhaps naturally, Lever felt that the failure of the soap combine was the result of animosity and resentment directed at him personally, rather than as a consequence of its members' dishonesty. Having sought several opinions on the authority of his suit, he retained Sir Edward Carson and two juniors, one of whom was Frederick Edwin Smith, later Lord Birkenhead. So he's basically going to take the newspapers to court. For the defendants, Rufus Isaacs, clearly a Jew, later Marquess of Reading and Viceroy of India, assisted by another KC and two juniors, acted for Associated Newspapers Limited. Lever's legal team were in no doubt of the outcome, as F.E. Smith reportedly observed, "There is no answer to this action for libel, and the damages must be enormous." On the 15th of July 1907, the case came up at Liverpool before Mr. Justice Lawrence. And I saw this guy, Rufus Isaacs. Obviously, that's a Jewish name. I've heard of the name Isaacs before, but I'm not really sure who he is. Do you know who this character is here that was one of the defendants, Max?
I only know that he was a prominent character during the early 20th century. I haven't got a great deal of information sort of readily available to share about him at the moment, I'm sorry to say.
He's quite a famous capitalist of the time, and he's working on the side of the newspapers against the paternal capitalism of Lever. The circumstances in which the trial took place were unusual, in that while Lever's legal team were accommodated at Thornton Manor, Lord Northcliffe, the principal witness for the defence, was overseas, and according to Jolly, had no intention of returning within range of any writ server while the case was on. And this Lord Northcliffe, he was something to do with Teddy Roosevelt and busting up the cartels in America, which was completely different, I think. It seems clear, therefore, that Northcliffe was in the wrong, because he had no intention of returning, basically. And moreover, he knew that he would most probably lose the case. He reportedly offered Lever a public apology shortly before the start of the trial. For the plaintiff, Carson accused Associated Newspapers of conducting a malicious campaign with the object of smashing up Lever Brothers. Speaking for more than 5 hours, he listed a number of complaints and asked the jury to award punitive damages. He then called Lever as his first witness, inviting the leader of the defence team to cross-examine him to his heart's content. And when his time comes, I hope he will be able to follow my example and do the same, and call as his first witness his own client, Lord Northcliffe, which of course he was not able to do. Such was the impression of Lever's demeanour and testimony on the defence team that as soon as the court was assembled on the following day, they capitulated completely. They also stated that on behalf of their clients that they wished to retract completely every imputation made upon Mr. Lever's honour and integrity, and express their deepest regrets for having made such malicious attacks upon him. There followed a scene on the floor of the court wherein the legal teams literally haggled over the size of the financial settlement. In the end, the sum agreed to was £50,000 plus around £40,000, which was eventually awarded from individual newspapers. This victory was celebrated with a day's holiday at Port Sunlight, where Lever addressed the employees and other spectators who cheered and applauded their hero. Lever Brothers had indeed been seriously damaged by the press, as well as by rises in the costs of raw materials, but Lever hesitated to use the court-awarded cash to bolster the company. Instead, he presented it all to Liverpool University, bestowing significant sums to the faculties of town planning, tropical medicine, and Russian studies, while making sure that an enduring record of the litigation was ensconced in the university library. And this is incredible that he beat the newspapers like this, and he beat them basically by his own character. by the person that he was once he started giving his testimony. And the guy that had, the main guy that had been doing all of this, this Lord Northcliffe, I mean, it must have been lies. It must have all been lies that he was doing. I mean, he just refused to come in there. Could not be examined. And this is unheard of, beating the newspapers like this and just getting them to capitulate like that.
And it was another sort of indication of Lever's benevolence and his benevolent intentions, that he donated the proceeds to these charitable causes.
Well, it's a long-standing tradition, isn't it, of capitalists giving out money and endowments. Proper philanthropists, you know, not like the philanthropists we're told we have today, like George Soros, the philanthropist that gives money to all these organizations to subvert countries, but genuine philanthropists who have made a lot of money, and then what they want to do is they want to help their people out, because they know that if it wasn't for their people, they wouldn't have been able to make all that money in the first place. I mean, we were taught today that we're just individuals and everybody is there for us to make as much profit as we can from. But everybody else around us is what makes us the people that we are today. Everything is built on what came before, and it's our duty to provide for those that come after us. Not our duty just to make whatever we can for ourselves. You know, no man is an island. And I think back then, this idea that it was your duty to do what you can for the people around you, I think that was the way that people thought. It wasn't an unnatural thing, whereas people today that think like that, you know, they get made out to be fools for thinking like that. And, they should be taking whatever they can for themselves. And if you do that, then, you know, you don't end up with a lot left, because everything starts to fall apart. Because we do rely on everyone else, and he understands this. That's why he's got this money, and he's given it to Liverpool University to improve the life outcomes of the students. I wonder why he was particularly interested in Russian studies. Why he thought that would be a good one.
What year are we talking about here? It's the very early 1900s, isn't it? There still would have been this close relationship between the royal family, the British royal family, and also the Russian royal family. That almost certainly would have been the link there.
Yes, it was before the First World War. Lever was a lifelong supporter of William Stuart Gladstone and liberalism, and he was invited to contest elections for the Liberal Party. He served as Member of Parliament for the Wirral constituency between 1906 and 1909, and used his maiden speech in the House of Commons to urge the government to introduce a national old age pension, such as the one that he himself provided for his workers. On the recommendation of the Liberal Party, he was created a baronet in 1911 and raised to the peerage as Baron Leverhulme on 21st of June 1917, with the Hulme element of his title being in honour of his wife, Elizabeth Hulme. And of course, back then, liberal ideas were very different to liberal ideas today. Liberal ideas back then was that we had free speech, and that you talked about things and came to... And you debated and you came to the fact of a matter through talking these things through, whereas liberalism today is just about censoring anybody else that has a different idea to yourself. And I do like the way that he used his maiden speech to introduce a proper national old age pension for the pensioners.
I think that again indicates incredible generosity on his part, that he was, you know, once his workers reached a certain age beyond which they were regarded as being perhaps incapable of working on, that he was prepared to pay them a pension for the rest of their lives. That's an incredibly generous thing.
Well, you imagine that isn't what these other companies used to do. I mean, you must have felt very proud to actually work for him. You can see from the way this is written, actually, in Wikipedia, that they're really sort of trying to have a dig at him. They don't want people to think that this guy was actually a genuinely nice character, genuinely trying to do his best for his people. In the early 1900s, Lever was using palm oil produced in the British West African colonies. And of course, today palm oil's got a very bad name today, because they're tearing down all the rainforests and they're putting up palm trees there so that they can harvest this this oil from it. But back then, 120 years ago, I mean, it was fairly sustainable. You had all these palm trees that weren't being used for anything else. So why not take the oil from them? So, you know, we have to be careful when we look at this that we don't see him as, being very damaging to the environment like the palm oil industry is today. When he found difficulties in obtaining more palm plantation concessions, see, these are plantations that were already there, he started looking elsewhere. In 1911, Lever signed a treaty with the Belgian government to gain access to the palm oil of the Belgian Congo. And he opened his operation under a subsidiary of the Lever Consortium named Huiliers du Congo Belge. And after buying a concession for 750,000 hectares, which is 900,000 acres of forest for palm oil production. The main coordinating base was established at Leverville, clearly named after him, in what was then the district of Quango, later a part of the province of Leopoldville. The company town of Leverville was a project born out of the shared desire of the Belgian government and of Lever Brothers to build a moral form of capitalism in Central Africa. For Belgium, Lever Brothers was an ideal partner, a company hailed for the social policies that it had put in place in Great Britain. For Lever, HCB was expected to become the crowning achievement of his own brand of moral capitalism. A few months before his death, Lord Leverholm, as he then was, wrote in a private letter that the Huiliers were a business like none other we have. Perhaps Port Sunlight comes nearest to it in social work. By 1923, a Lever soap factory was built there, and by 1924, Savco, or Savonneries Congolaises, was established. Now, this is very interesting because the Belgian government today, and particularly King Leopold, whose name was given to this Leopoldville, he is made out to be an absolute demon, and they completely mistreated all the Africans there. And a lot of this is down to a book that was written about 20 years ago by a communist author. It was known that there was some bad treatment at the time, nothing like what we are told today. It is a way of smearing whites, and particularly smearing this King Leopold. And what this shows, by the fact that they got Lever in there to set up his factory there, and also to set up the way of employing people like he did in Britain, this shows that they weren't there trying to oppress the Africans. They wanted to set up for them the best employment that there possibly could be. You couldn't get better than Port Sunlight. You couldn't get better than having a house provided for you and a museum there and schools and everything right close by to where you work. And this is what they were doing in Africa. This is what this King Leopold was doing with Lever in Africa. And this shows that they weren't trying to mistreat these Africans. They were trying to bring them this enlightened way of doing things and look after them. I find this quite incredible, because it's really totally the opposite that you would expect this Belgian organization to be doing if you believed the propaganda that we hear about it today. You want to think about
that? That's an interesting point, actually, one I hadn't thought of before. But yeah, I think that does indicate an entirely different attitude on the part of the Belgians than they're credited for today.
We also have an episode devoted to the atrocity hoax about Belgium in the Orthodox Nationalist series by Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, where he goes into this book that was written by the communist, and he establishes the actual evidence for what happened. So our listeners can look that up at Radio Albion by going to the Orthodox Nationalist archive. Lever's attitudes towards the Congolese were paternalistic, and his views were much more caring than most other industrialists of the time. Malcolm Hardman writes that Lever observed and respected the intelligence and integrity of the Congolese that he was allowed to meet. Sir William Lever, baronet as he had become in December 1911, firmly believed that paid labour alongside the schools, hospitals and rations his company promised to provide would attract workers. However, And it says here, the harshness and danger of the labour demanded from them and living in camps away from their homes, as well as the poor remuneration that HCB offered, failed to interest them. And again, that there's just no real explanation for this. The Congolese didn't want to work there. They provided these houses for them, schools, hospitals, everything that they had at Port Sunlight. And yet the Congolese just did not want to go and live there. They didn't want to work there. And there's no real explanation for this. Failing to find sufficient voluntary workers, the HCB turned to the Belgian colonial authorities. And it says here, a brutal regime notorious for their use of a system of forced labour. The Belgians were grateful to have a partnership with an enlightened entrepreneur to help salvage their battered reputation, and it allowed Lever to recruit the Congolese workforce that he needed. Leverhulme's participation in this system of formalised labour has been documented by Jules Marchal, who contends that Leverhulme set up a private kingdom reliant on the horrific Belgian system of forced labour, a programme that reduced the population of Congo by half and accounted for more deaths than the Nazi Holocaust. And that is a quote from a discredited book written by the aforementioned communist that Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson has thoroughly debunked in his series, The Orthodox Nationalist. The archives show a record of Belgian administrators, missionaries and doctors protesting against the practices at the Lever plantations. Formal parliamentary investigations by the Belgian Parliament were called for by members of the Belgian Socialist Party. And this I don't really get, because they're saying, well, it was forced labour and all the rest of it, but he had provided all these houses for them. They'd been offered the wages to go and work there. They didn't want to go and work there. So the Belgian system, whatever it was that they had, I mean, it says here that it was forced labour. I don't think they were using slaves. They weren't using slaves back then. There was no more slavery that was left in the world. I mean, maybe they had a strict system of labour, and if you misbehaved, maybe there was some corporal punishment that was involved. Perhaps it was prisoners, criminals that had done something wrong. But I don't think it was. It doesn't make sense, does it? He's offered people wages, good wages, and he's offered them all the perks and the benefits that the British people have. And the Congolese have said, no, we don't want to do that. And then you've got the Belgian government that then provides the labour. And we're then told that this was absolutely terrible and they must have been mistreated. But I don't see how they can have been mistreated if they were offered all of these perks and benefits. It's very strange.
Well, I suppose it is possible that the Congolese people, they wouldn't have been a uniform population, but that there would have been different tribal groups. Some of the tribal groups probably liked their tribal way of life and living in a rainforest. One of the features of a rainforest is that indigenous peoples living in a rainforest can usually walk around lopping the odd sort of coconut from the top of a tree, or a bunch of grapes, or digging up a root of a plant, or hunting the game, which is fairly plentiful in those rainforests. They can live out what is for them a very happy lifestyle, and what may have appeared to them is that these Europeans came along and started to build plantations and wanted them to come work on plantations, and they thought, well, no, actually I don't want to work all day on a plantation. I would far rather just continue to wander through the rainforest collecting food in a sort of hunter-gatherer fashion, as my ancestors have done before me and their ancestors before them. So it is possible that there could have been a degree of coercion used in order to get people to work. But if there was, that would have been the wrong thing to do, and the right thing to have done would have been for the surplus populations of Britain and Europe who had no work and who didn't have land and who were then being pushed into
slums, wasn't it, in the cities?
Well, not just slums, but what is the I can't remember what the phrase is for sort of semi-slavery, where you've
indentured servitude.
Indentured servitude, that was a phrase I couldn't think of, yeah, who were being pushed into indentured servitude and being shipped over to the Caribbean, because, you know, something like one in five of all of the slaves that were employed in the Caribbean and the southern states of America were actually originally of white descent. And so, you know, there was a surplus population that didn't have land. And these were people who, if they were lucky, were shipped out to places like Australia, where there was vast expanses of unoccupied territory. But in the Congo Basin, there probably would have been lots of tribes already well established there. But and if those tribes didn't want to work on plantations, then surplus workers from Britain and other countries in Europe should have been encouraged to go out there and work, and then they would have been used to working in the way that Lever wanted them to work. Leverholm wanted them to work, and I imagine that could have been done with far less in terms of social disruption for the Congolese. The Congolese could have continued to be left in the jungle, and the European workers could have worked in the plantations that were created for them by Leverholm and by the Belgian government.
I think also that Leverholm may have been given a false impression of these Congolese as well. I mean, it says he respected the intelligence and integrity of the Congolese he was allowed to meet. Obviously, they would have put forward the brightest and the best of the Congolese that had been university educated, and he may have then formed the impression that the rest of the Congolese were like that, and they have a much lower average IQ than we have. Obviously, there's going to be outliers that are at the top range of that, and they would have been the Congolese that he was allowed to meet. So he may have had the impression that that they were just going to be the same as the people that he had met, maybe not quite as bright, but certainly not with IQs in the 60-70 range. I don't know what it was that they actually developed the IQ test, which actually measured these things and quantified them. So perhaps he wasn't used to this. I mean, it's quite clear that he didn't understand the difference between the races, I think, because otherwise he would have thought, well, you know, perhaps this might not work. And yeah, I think you're right, Max. I think that they didn't quite understand what was being offered to them. Why would they not want to just wander through the jungle, capturing whatever crosses their path? You know, why would they want to work there, cutting down the palm trees just because they've got this, this properly built house? You know, they can live in a hut. They can build a hut wherever they want, can't they? Why would they want to be stuck in one place living in this house? Why would they want their children to be going there into the school when they could have the children going out catching food for them or whatever the employment sort of things that they had to keep these children going? So you can see there's two different ways of doing things, and it just didn't work in the Congo. It just didn't work. It's a very interesting little part of history there that I wasn't aware of until.
And again, that would have been another aspect of multiculturalism getting things wrong, in assuming that you can push people from entirely different ethnic backgrounds into a working lifestyle that they're not, that is just contrary to their nature, and so rather than do that, as I said, that they should have allowed the surplus populations of Europe and Britain to go out there and settle in the Congo and be the workers on the plantations, rather than trying to persuade or coerce the local natives to do that sort of work. You see, where we find people who continue to live in the Amazon basin, there are still some, and I think you can still find some that live in Central Africa in the Congo basin, who still live lives pretty much exactly the same as the lives of their grandparents and great grandparents going back in time. There is an entirely different sense of time. And one of the things that those indigenous peoples have tried to do over the millennia that have passed since the Stone Age is for them to achieve a situation of equilibrium or balance. And this is why the idea of there being a balance of nature doesn't really work, because if you try to create a balance of nature between the way in which you work and the environment in which you find yourself, then what happens is you ultimately reach a point where you are using the resources that are available to you in the environment that are freely available to their maximum. And from that point onwards, you can't then have any further scientific development or industrial development or farming development. And you, the importance for you is that you keep life exactly the same as it was for your parents, so that you don't start to, draw more from the environment than the environment is capable of giving, and that then creates that then causes your culture to stultify and to cease any further development. And that's why there are these indigenous populations that you do find scattered around the third world who are still living in the Stone Age, because their parents achieved a point of equilibrium with their environment, and then the importance to maintain that their way of life involved them in keeping everything the same. And so people would grow up and you know, one boy would lead pretty much exactly the same life as his father, and would have the same number of children as his father did, so that the population or the community as a whole would have the same number of children as the previous generation, so that the community stayed the same size, and the way in which they lived and the route in which they nomadically wandered through the jungle collecting food as was their way remained the same. And because of that, their lifestyle was retained in perpetuity by doing that. But what it then meant was that in other parts of the world where people had a different sense of time, had a sense that we're on this earth in order to advance the knowledge and the influence and the capacity of our people. When they then came into contact with Europeans, what they found was that these indigenous people found that the Europeans that visited them had not stood still in the way that they'd stood still from a scientific and a technological point of view, and that we had technologies that were far in advance of their technologies, because we'd built ships and we'd created machines and we had developed science, etc. And so that was why they then lost out in competition with the European explorers and settlers that went out to Africa from Europe.
It's like we have a sense of being in a place in time, and time advancing and us advancing almost as if you're advancing from one place to another, that advancing from one place to another in time from one development to another, whereas these indigenous peoples, I don't think they really had that concept. They didn't have the concept of history. You know, they had the concept of their life and that was it.
That's right. Their concept was effectively Groundhog Day. Every day had to be the same as the previous day, because if you did something different the following day, then that would change the balance of nature and possibly upset the balance of nature. And so every child was raised in the same way that their parents had been raised, and was taught to hunt and to live in exactly the same way as their parents had had learned to hunt and live and been taught by their parents. And so because change meant disturbing the balance of nature, and keeping the balance of nature was essential to their survival, they didn't change. They always kept everything the same. There are social scientists that have done sort of work on this sort of thing, and they talk about how indigenous populations have what's called ceremonial time, because most of these indigenous populations have a kind of religion whereby there is some kind of intoxicant plant or whatever, whether it's alcohol or whether it's some sort of plant root that's got a particular drug in it, that they will have means of taking an intoxicating drug that then gives them hallucinations, and they very often believe that they are their parents, that they are able to not only are they their parents reborn, but they can also talk to their dead parents and their dead grandparents, and so and have what's called ceremonial time where they do this. Whereas, as far as Europeans are concerned, we've developed linear time where time begins at a certain point and then various developments are made, various actions happen, various events take place, and we create history. Whereas for the indigenous peoples, they don't have a history because all they have is the memory of their parent who was identical to them. And so who was in turn identical to their grandparent. And so their own individual personality merges into this kind of non-linear time concept of themselves as being the people.
So they just had no real capacity to understand what was actually being done for them by Liverholm setting up the equivalent of Port Sunlight there. I mean, this is Absolutely. What he said at the end of his life, a business like none other we have. Perhaps Port Sunlight comes nearest to it in social work. So he's effectively saying that what they had there was even better than Port Sunlight. And he wrote that a few months before his death. So that has to be the explanation for it, doesn't it? They just did not have the capacity to understand what just what was being done for them.
Let's talk about something positive.
Yeah, and he really is positive, this greatest Briton of ours that we have been discussing. We will be talking about Lord Leverholm, William Hesketh Lever, and we'll start with a recap. Last episode, we heard how Lever took the press to court and had them admitting defeat before he had even finished being cross-examined by the lawyers. He gave the money he made in compensation to universities and other worthy causes, not keeping any of it for himself or for his company. He then moved into Africa, building a replica Port Sunlight for the Congolese that he thought was even better than the first one. But the natives did not understand what was so good about it, and they did not want to give up their simple lives for one that required responsibility. Because of this, the Belgian government provided the labour to him for his venture, and since they were later accused of mistreating the natives, Lever's name has also become associated with this. But no mistreatment of employees would have gone on with his knowledge, because everything he did was for his employees' benefit. And then this week we're going to hear about his adventures in Scotland. But do you want to add anything to that recap first, Max?
Well, just that when we discussed this last week, we mentioned about the sort of cultural difference in the concept of time, where there is the sort of white Western concept of time being what's generally termed by scientists nowadays as technological time, where time is a linear thing, where human beings evolved and civilization was created, and and each successive generation of civilization built on the shoulders of the people beforehand, so that civilization was a progression. And this is the way in which history used to be taught, that civilization started off with very primitive ways of life and then progressed, and that the way that we in the West lead our lives nowadays used to be regarded as the pinnacle of the progress of Western civilization, and people look forward to greater progress being made in the future, so that things could become even better than they had been in the past. Whereas as far as indigenous populations are concerned, probably like the indigenous population of the Congo, they would have had a different concept of time, what evolutionary psychologists call ceremonial time or dream time. You often hear of Aboriginal natives from Australia talking about dream time, and this is a concept of a cyclical concept of time, where each day is a repeat of the previous day, each month is a repeat of the previous month, each year is a repeat of the previous year, and where people strive to live in harmony with their environment by never striving for more, effectively. And it's kind of like a civilization built upon the concept of Groundhog Day, where you don't change the way that you live, because otherwise it will disturb the ecological balance of these indigenous people living in a state of nature, and that the problem faced by the Belgians and also by Leverhulme in the Congo was would have been, in my view, largely as a result of the two different concepts between the West and the Aboriginal peoples of the Congo, and where there was strife caused, and where perhaps there was some coercion of the Africans to make them work in the way that the Belgian government wanted, it would have been as a result of that.
That's what would have looked bad on Leverhulme. I was just thinking there when you were saying that, Max. I think actually Christianity actually played a part in getting us to see ourselves as advancing from one place to another, because it had all these prophecies in the Bible about these great empires that were to come and things that were to come in the future, which I don't think we'd really sort of had before. I guess we sort of knew about Ragnarok, but not in such detail. I mean, Dr. E. Michael Jones has talked about this and how that way of looking at things mixed with the Greek philosophical way of looking at things, which gave us Christianity. And obviously the Congolese didn't experience any of that. They were just experiencing what was going on from one day to the next, and they didn't want to complicate their simple lives, I guess. Well, moving back to Britain and Scotland, in May 1918, by then in semi-retirement, Baron Leverhulme, as he was now known, bought the Isle of Lewis for £167,000. And in late 1919, he bought the estate of South Harris for £36,000, both of them in the Outer Hebrides, Scotland. And I mean, that's quite incredible. He was able to actually buy an island. I didn't know that you could do that. You sort of imagine that they're owned by the government if they've got people that are living on them. But have you heard of this before, Max, being able to just buy an island in Britain?
Yeah, I have heard of people buying islands. The prices nowadays, though, are considerably higher than they were in Lord Leverhulme's day. I mean, you'd be looking at something like 167 million, I would think, to buy even an island much smaller than the Island of Lewis. I mean, the Isle of Lewis would probably be an astronomical amount you'd have to pay for that nowadays. But you get people that also buy these. During the Second World War, there were forts that were built in the shallow seas around the coast of Britain that were then manned by sort of cannons and machine guns, etc., to deter invasion. And you do occasionally hear of people of those coming up for sale as well, and so people buy those and then convert them into plush offshore homes. And I can imagine that there will be lots of people who've been who've become fabulously wealthy for one reason or another, who will look around and think, oh yeah, it'd be very nice to have an island that would keep the hoi polloi from my door, and they would do that.
Well, it looks like Lever bought this island because he wanted to improve the lives of the people that were on it. His plans for their future prosperity centered upon the application of modern science and his own business skills in establishing a large and thriving fishing industry. And of course, there is already a fishing industry in Scotland, but he wanted to completely reimagine it. Lord Leverhulme intended that the port should be improved and enlarged to attract landings of fish from visiting vessels to supplement the catches made by local boats, and his own fleet of modern drifters and trawlers. There would be an ice-making factory and cargo vessels with refrigerated holds to take the fresh fish to a depot on the British mainland at Fleetwood, Lancashire, which was well-placed to serve the industrial towns of the north of England. Leverhulme also expanded the herring curing capacity and enlarged the fish processing facilities with the installation of a canning factory and a plant to make fish cakes, fish paste, glue, animal feed and fertiliser, with similar equipment being established at Fleetwood. And we often forget, you know, we were talking about natural resources earlier. One of our greatest natural resources that we've always had is all the fish that we have that surround us. And it's quite amazing, really, that we aren't more involved in the actual eating of this fish. The vast majority of it gets exported to Europe rather than by us eating it, I guess, where we're surrounded by it all the time. So he's basically setting up this big improvement to the fish industry. Typically, Leverhulme's business strategies were comprehensive and meticulously set out. His plans for the island called for a reliable workforce. But although the inhabitants of Stornoway were generally well-educated and hard-working, they were, for the most part, regularly employed and well-paid. The largely Gaelic-speaking crofters, on the other hand, were mainly subsistence farmers, and many of them were squatters. And it was this section of the population that Leverhulme hoped to develop and recruit. The crofters were poor, but they were used to an independent lifestyle that was both long-established and deeply ingrained in their psyche. Nevertheless, Leverhulme planned to entice them into becoming carbon copies of his Lancashire artisans by offering them an attractive alternative to their meagre small holdings. He did not actively oppose the crofters' way of life, but neither did he support it as some thought that he, as their patron, ought to have done. When the crofters learned about the money that was being expended on other projects, they began to resent his lack of support for them. And I don't think it was so much that he wasn't supporting them. I think he was looking at what they were doing and he was thinking, well, this isn't going to be financially viable in the future. We need to set something up for these people something different that they can learn to do so that they can still stay here in this island with the way of life that they've had for many, many years, but they need to be doing something productive and they need some way of earning money. Otherwise, all of that is going to be lost. So he was really putting them first, I think, by setting all of this up for them. But they weren't able to see that far ahead. And they were thinking, well, why isn't he supporting the crofting? Well, because the crofting isn't financially viable. And I think when we look at the amount of crofters that there are now, we can see why he was doing this. Because if they had taken him up on this, they would all still be able to be living in these islands, which I think now they're pretty much priced out of living there. It's the rich that want to go and live in these rural places. The same as throughout Britain, in the most beautiful rural places that used to be the cheapest places to live, have now become some of the most expensive places to live. And the locals that have lived there for centuries can no longer buy a house there. You know, I'm thinking of particularly of Cornwall here, where nobody can afford to live in Cornwall anymore that's actually Cornish born and bred. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Well, just that the same kind of psychology was involved as far as the crofters are concerned. If you're a subsistence farmer, and it's not just the Scots crofters that sort of fell into this same trap, there would have been similar subsistence farmers in other parts of the British Isles and also in other parts of Europe. And the point is that subsistence is, or the subsistence concept is the same concept of trying to keep the way that you live in harmony with your natural environment. And once you reach a point where you are fully exploiting your natural environment, then you won't change anything, because otherwise it will disturb the balance and it will prevent you from subsisting from the natural environment. And so that then tends to cause that the people that live that way to fall behind relative to those people who are striving for more, striving to do things better, striving to expand and advance civilization. And so as far as those, and you're absolutely right, as far as those subsistence farmers are concerned, had they tried to remain as subsistence economies, then they would eventually have been outstripped by other people producing the same thing that they produce, but on the mainland, where they would perhaps have more automated techniques, etc. Unless you introduce legislation to preserve the kind of skills that are involved in the hand making of things, and I can see that there are perhaps two markets, one market being for handmade goods, which would tend to be very expensive, and the other market for machine made goods, which would tend to be less expensive by comparison, and you can see that where something and this is an issue which is interlinked with the issue that we spoke about previously with one of our previous Greatest Britons, where we were talking about the fulfillment that people get from from manufacturing, where somebody who actually is part of a team of people who make a complete car, who take all the component parts of a car, who actually make the component parts of a car and then bolt them all together to make a car, you get far more fulfillment out of doing that than you would do if you were the person who puts the third screw in from the left on the engine as the car comes past you on an assembly line. And so that there is a balance to be had, I think, because there is something to be said for the sort of slower pace of life that exists within a subsistence economy. There is something to be said from the point of view of creating from a mental health point of view. But on the other hand, there has to be a balance so that the subsistence way of life isn't so intensively followed and so restrictively followed that it means that the people that follow that way of life become left behind by the rest of civilization.
Yeah, I mean, these farmers, they could have kept on doing some of the subsistence farming, but also working in the new fish factories and on the port there and on the docks and getting involved in that, and still stayed where they were. I mean, it's very sad what's happened to the crofting, and I think he was looking ahead and thinking, well they could do both, and this would preserve this, but they just didn't understand that. Leverhulme did his utmost to woo the population of Lewis and to make himself, as well as his schemes, popular among all the islanders. This seems to have worked to some extent, but there were other sceptics whose voices were heard in government circles. Robert Munro, the Secretary of State for Scotland, and Donald Murray, the MP for the Western Isles, as well as a number of supporting characters, including most of the House of Commons, were anxious to redress past oppression of the Highlanders, who had so recently served with outstanding bravery in the First World War. The Small Landholders of Scotland Act 1911 had empowered the Scottish Secretary on behalf of His Majesty's Government to acquire certain farms in the Highlands and Islands by compulsory purchase, and to have them divided up to provide more crofts. In 1913, four farms on Lewis had been scheduled for takeover, but the action had been opposed by the proprietor at that time, and when the war with Germany broke out, it was left in abeyance. Towards the end of the war, in the summer of 1918, the Scottish office first proposed to Leverhulme that under the Small Landholders Act, the Board of Agriculture should take possession of certain of his farms and create something fewer than 150 crofts. Leverhulme was against this, even though some local politicians believed that Leverhulme's project and the provision of more crofts were not mutually exclusive. But Leverhulme firmly believed that he could greatly improve living standards to an extent that crofting would become a forgotten way of life. He was also impatient with politicians' machinations and the laborious indolence of the political system that persisted with the, quote, futile land reform, instead of adopting what he considered the most sensible course of action, to forget about new crofts and allow him, in the interests of expediency, to behave like the monarch of the Western Isles. So, I mean, we have to remember, I mean, he is an eccentric and he did name places after him, but he did put the needs of the people that were his employees above everything else. So he's saying, we don't want to have new crofts here. We want to build a way of life for these people that is actually going to fund them, because these crofts are not financially viable, whereas the government are saying, well, we want to reward people that have been fighting in the war by giving them these crofts. And they wanted to take one of his farms to actually do this. Were you aware of this before, Max? The government actually wanting to help out or make amends for the Highland clearances, or any of this that was going on before the war and after?
I wasn't specifically aware of this, no. But I mean, it's again, all of what you've just outlined to us supports what I said about that. There needing to be a balance between the personal fulfillment that people get through hand making things in a subsistence way, and the needs of providing what's the word I'm thinking of here? It's sustainability as a result of technological advances and organizing their society in a more efficient way, and so to a certain extent, I think Lord Leverhulme was going perhaps a bit too far and a bit too fast. And he perhaps needed to slow down and then bring the people who were wanting to promote the Crofting way of life with him. But the point is that Lord Leverhulme eventually lost out in this. And so what's now happened is that the crofting cottage industries that previously existed in the Highlands of Scotland and in the Hebrides, etc., they have become pretty much anachronistic, and the young people being born into these into the communities that exist on those islands have left Scotland, and that's why population of Scotland has dwindled somewhat, or hasn't grown to any great extent, and this is why the current Prime Minister of Scotland is so keen to have immigrants going to Scotland, because to make up for the fact that young people, when they reach the age at which they can leave home, tend to leave home and come to move south or move into the big cities in Scotland in order to make a career, because there isn't a career for them in the Highlands of the Islands of Scotland. Had more people had more emphasis been given to Lord Leverhulme, then there probably would still be viable industries in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland, and there wouldn't be such a problem with the sort of brain drain of the young leaving in order to make their fortunes elsewhere.
That's the really sad thing, isn't it? I mean, he lost out, and as a result, the people of the Hebrides ended up losing out. The crofters ended up losing out, because they didn't just end up losing their way of life. They ended up losing any way of doing anything else, and they had to move out, or their children did. Thus, by the beginning of 1919, the positions taken up by those involved were fairly well defined. Robert Munro, himself a Highlander, believed passionately in the reinstatement of the crofts, and he also felt strongly that the Imperial Parliament at Westminster was unlikely to tolerate any departure from the implementation of land reform. But he saw no reason why Lewis should not have Leverhulme's industrial schemes as well as more crofts. Leverhulme refused to budge, believing that the breakup of his farms would lead to seriously inefficient, probably unsustainable, and ultimately abandoned smallholdings, as crofters moved away in search of better incomes. Ranged against this, at least ostensibly reasonable prediction, was the formidable influence wielded by prospective crofters away fighting in France, as well as by supporters of the Highland League, which was politically dedicated to land reform. So you've actually got people that are away fighting the war that have been told that they're going to be given farms when they come back. I know they built these houses for a lot of the people that fought in the First World War. They called them homes for heroes. I didn't realise they were sort of giving them away farms as well, and making all these promises to them. Do you know much about that?
I don't know that the farms would have been given away, but that they probably would have been made available on advantageous terms. I know that in a lot of the Highlands and Islands of Scotland, there are bylaws that exist. I think they're bylaws. There may be more sort of widespread than that. But where in order to buy a croft, you have to be born of a crofting family, effectively. So it's an attempt to sort of try and maintain the communities in the Highlands by introducing that kind of situation. But all that does is that stops other people from other parts of the country who might actually like the idea of leading a crofting lifestyle, of moving to these islands and sustaining and maintaining the population levels there. And this whole issue is core to the reason why Scotland has become depopulated, and why there are large tracts of Scotland where there's very, very sparse population, because of resistance to people like Lord Leverhulme, who, insofar as he went a little bit too far, a little bit too fast, I can accept that. That may well be there may be some justification for that attitude, but at the end of the day, there needed to be industries that were on a sufficient scale so that they could manufacture goods and produce products at a cost that would keep them viable for the future, so that there would continue to be work there for young people and for the people who were crofters.
Well, I think we also see similar animosities today, don't we? Or we did do to Donald Trump, who is trying to set up golf courses and bring lots of business to Scotland. And we saw this big movement against him, basically, all this animosity against him when he was really trying to help the Scots out. And I must say, it's very commendable of this Robert Munro, the loyalty that he shows to his fellow Highlanders. But it was misplaced in the plans that he actually had for them. In early March 1919, men started to take over Leverholm's farms on Lewis. They drove off the farmers' livestock, demolished boundary walls, and staked out 6-acre plots. By the summer, 16 out of the 22 farms on the island had been affected. Expecting Leverholm's approval, the raiders were taken aback when he voiced his complete condemnation of their actions and asked them to withdraw from his land. Some left, but others erected shelters for their families on the stolen plots. Leverholm was evidently not willing to prosecute ex-servicemen who were trying to secure homes for their families, and it seems unlikely that under the circumstances legal action would have succeeded. Instead, he toured Lewis trying to persuade them that their future lay with him and not in the crofting system. They were, however, extremely reluctant to abandon the old ways, and most of them continued to espouse the crofting way of life. So he's basically got big enough farms that are actually financially viable, and what they've done is break them all down into 6-acre plots which are not financially viable, and they're squatting, and instead of taking them to court, because he doesn't want to do that, because these men have just fought in the war and they're just trying to provide for their families. So he's trying to say, well, look, you can provide for your families by working in the way that I'm trying to set up here, which will last for generations. But they didn't want to listen. And this is the first I've heard of this, stealing farms and all this excitement going on up in the Hebrides.
I wasn't quite as aware of all of that, those aspects as perhaps I might be as well. And but it still illustrates the this dichotomy between the sort of technological time and sort of ceremonial time or whatever, where indigenous, because the crofters would have been the indigenous people of the Highlands and Islands of Scotland. And it was that they wanted to maintain the crofting lifestyle, because that would then mean that they would live in the same way that their parents lived, and would retain the same culture. And you can understand, that sort of a lifestyle would have its attractions. However, the passage of time has shown that if you have too extreme a desire to resist change in order to retain your old way of life, that it does then have a detrimental effect, because you then find yourself in competition with people who are producing things on an industrial scale, and from a price perspective, you can't hold your own. So there is some joy to be had from leading a sort of a crofting lifestyle. And when we were speaking about it before, and going back to the analogy of people building a car from scratch, you do get a great sense of satisfaction out of hand making something, and that there should always be a market for handmade goods that are made with the skill of a craftsman's eye and the skill of a craftsman's hands. But they will always have to be very, very expensive in order to create a business model that would make it profitable to produce those. If you're going to compete with people that are making machine finished goods or machine manufactured goods for the mass market, then you're always going to be priced out of the market if you try to retain a crofting lifestyle that isn't supported by the sort of higher prices that hand making things demands or commands.
Yeah, I think he certainly had sympathy for their way of life. I mean, he's had his farm stolen from him, and he's not sort of fighting back or anything. He's just trying to say to them, well, look, this isn't the best way of going about doing things. where attitudes began to harden and polarise, culminating in politicians pressing ahead with land reform and Leverhulme demanding a 10-year moratorium, coupled with a thinly veiled threat to withdraw from his schemes. In early 1920, upon his return from a business trip to the States, Leverhulme learned that the raiding had continued during his absence. By this time, serious financial difficulties were besetting Lever Brothers concerning the disastrous Niger Company, making his decision about the Western Isles project relatively straightforward. With a pressing need to make significant savings, he announced his intention to concentrate his efforts on Stornoway and on Harris, and that all work in the country area of Lewis would be abandoned forthwith. So you think about that. I mean, he's put a lot of money into this as well, trying to sort this out, provide an income for these people in the years to come. And he's lost all of that. And he's also lost all his properties there. The population of Harris was smaller in size and more scattered than that of Lewis. Consequently, Leverhulme's plans advanced there with very few problems. With permission from the locals, the fishing village of Obi was renamed Leverborough. On the 3rd of September 1923, Viscount Leverhulme, as he had become the previous year, addressed the Stornoway Council and the Lewis District Council at a meeting which he had asked to be specially convened on that date. Lord Leverhulme asked them to take the land and make their system work. But only Stornoway, always on Leverhulme's side, accepted the gift, set up the trust, and to a large extent made it work for the benefit of the town. Left with so much of the island that he no longer wanted, Leverhulme sold off as much as he could, but many of the buyers were interested principally in shooting and fishing. So basically, the Crofters ended up losing out. Leverhulme ended up losing out. He just gave the island to them. Basically, he said, "Look, you can have the island, and make your system work. You can have it." But they did not, or some of them set up the gift, but the rest of them didn't. I think is what it is saying here. He asked them to take the land and make the system work, but only Stornoway accepted the gift and set up the trust. So the rest of them didn't. And sadly, very soon afterwards, Leverhulme died. He died in May 1925. And soon after that, the board of Lever Brothers gave orders for all the development on Harris to stop too. And so Leverhulme's scheme for the Western Isles perished with almost nothing achieved there. I mean, that is very sad. So if we just finish up by taking a look at his legacy here. Before he died, he was made High Sheriff of Lancashire in 1917, and in November 1918, Leverhulme was invited to become the Mayor of Bolton because the council wanted to honour a notable son of the town as a mark of the high regard the citizens of Bolton had for him. He was elevated to the Viscountcy on 27th of November 1922 and died at the age of 73 of pneumonia at his home in Hampstead on the 7th of May 1925. And some people would say, well, he always used to sleep in the open air. He used to literally remove the windows from the houses that he was sleeping in the bedroom, so it was always open to the fresh air. And some people would suggest that may have caused this pneumonia, but I would have thought that he would have built up a resistance to things like that, and a resistance to the cold. I mean, we used to live without central heating and we managed to survive. So that was just one of his eccentricities. And his wife also died of pneumonia as well some years before. His funeral was attended by 30,000 people. And that's a lot of people. And he is buried, isn't it? I mean, that's massive. And he is buried in the churchyard of Christ Church in Port Sunlight in what was then Cheshire and is now Merseyside. He was succeeded by his son, William Lever, 2nd Viscount Leverhulme. He was a major benefactor to his native town Bolton, where he was made a Freeman of the County Borough in 1902. In 1899, he brought Hall Itherwood, one-time home of Samuel Crompton, and restored it as a museum for the town. He donated 360 acres of land and landscaped Lever Park in Rivington in 1902. He was responsible for the formation of Bolton School, after re-endowing Bolton Grammar School and Bolton High School for Girls in 1913. He donated the land for Bolton's largest park, Leverhulme Park, in 1914, And in 1920, he donated £50 to the Selborne Society campaign to purchase land in West London as the Gilbert White Memorial. It is now known as the Perivale Wood Local Nature Reserve. He endowed a school of tropical medicine at Liverpool University, gave Lancaster House in London to the British nation, and endowed the Leverholm Trust, set up to provide funding for education and research. The trust in 2017 became benefactor to Rivington and Blackrod High School and Harper Green School, both becoming Leverholm Church of England academies in Bolton. The garden of his former London residence, The Hill, in Hampstead, designed by Thomas Mawson, is open to the public and has been renamed Inverforth House. A blue plaque at Inverforth House commemorating Leverholm was unveiled by his great-granddaughter, Jane Heber Percy, in 2002. He also built many houses in Thornton Hoff, which became a model village comparable to Port Sunlight, and in 1906 he built St George's United Reformed Church. The Lady Lever Art Gallery opened in 1922 and is in the Port Sunlight Conservation Area. Much of Leverholm's art collection is displayed in the gallery, which houses one of the finest collections formed by an industrialist in England. And Port Sunlight is still there today. People can go and visit it, go and have a look around it. It's part of a conservation area there. I mean, we can see here that he didn't just look after his employees, he looked after everybody else around him and all the people that he lived with when he was brought up in Bolton. A really, really nice guy, a genuine British eccentric that really put it into practice, this idea of wanting to do your best for your people. And he really did succeed in doing that. You got any final thoughts on Lord Lever here, Max?
Well, just a great benefactor, really. And I think that the undoing of his plans in Scotland were, you know, as I said, probably as a result of moving a little bit too fast for people. Perhaps he could have tried to incorporate elements of the crofting communities and society that existed on those islands into his plans a little bit more to make the his ideas a little bit more palatable to the people of the islands. And it's quite sad that everything came to naught at the end of the day. And that as a result of that, the industries that could have been sustained in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland have dwindled away. And the populations of those areas have become much sparser than they might otherwise have been. But you know, when you look at all of the endowments that he made, when you look at all of the gifts that he gave to various groups and to various schools and places of science, etc., you know, he definitely was a great man and somebody that whose life should serve as a model to other people nowadays.
Yeah, especially if you're an employer. I mean, or you run a business, this is the sort of man who you want to follow in his footsteps and look after your employees. It's just such a great shame that, you know, the crofters and the Congolese were not as far, they couldn't see as further forward in time as he did. They just weren't as visionary as he was. But yeah, he definitely deserves to be in our greatest Britons. And I'm very thankful to Michael Woodbridge for suggesting him to us. If anybody else has any suggestions for Greatest Britons that we should cover, then please do let us know. Thank you very much for listening. And do remember that you can check out the Greatest Britons archive page at radioalbion.com to find our former presentations on our Greatest Britons. And remember to keep an eye out in the future for new ones.